You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The efforts to undermine political mobilization in the lead-up to the G20 Leaders Summit in Toronto involved one of the largest intelligence and security operations in Canadian history. Over 1,000 people were arrested before and during the summit. 300 people were charged. And a small group of people were identified as ringleaders and charged with conspiracy. 2 weeks ago, 17 members of the so-called G20 main conspiracy group reached a collective plea deal. No one was convicted of conspiracy, but six of the defendants pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of counseling to commit mischief. Two of the defendants, Alex Hundert and Amanda Hiscox, also pleaded guilty to counseling to obstruct police. 11 other defendants had their charges withdrawn. Alex Hundert is a founding member of AWOL, a direct action group based out of the Kitchener-Waterloo Community Center for Social Justice. He's also an Indigenous solidarity activist. Alex Hundert joins us today from Ontario. Hello, Alex.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing okay this morning.
You were arrested in the lead-up to the G20 and charged with conspiracy. Where were you when you were arrested?
I was actually in my own home. It was the very early on the morning of the 26th. We had a SWAT team-style raid of our home. They kind of burst through the door, guns drawn. It's pretty standard operational procedure for the actual cops who busted us. They do that kind of raid in Toronto on a very regular basis.
And what were the charges based on?
The charges were based on we had been participating in a series of meetings that lasted, that started in 2008, in fact, preparing for the Olympics and the G8, G20, and the SPP. And there had been a series of infiltrations of activist groups across the country. And several of the groups that I work very closely with, including AWOL, were infiltrated by undercover cops, and they had been at our meeting processes. So we were initially charged with conspiracy charges, which is basically we were arrested for the organizing itself.
What kind of impact have those charges had on your life over the past, I guess it's been 18 months?
What kind of impact?
It's a big question, I know.
Yeah, it's been quite substantial impact. So in Kitchener, for example, AWOL is now defunct, as is the KW Community Center for Social Justice, which we opened and ran for 3 years. Both are shut down. There are new projects in Kitchener that the AWOL members who weren't charged are involved in. But that whole kind of thrust and momentum there was kind of put a stop to. They ended up, 6 of 12 active AWOL members were initially charged in the conspiracy. 3 of us ended up having to plead guilty. So the group took a big hit. In terms of my own life, I've had this ridiculous no demonstration condition that most of the 17 of us had, but that has been kind of applied to me in much stricter ways than to other people, which has meant that I haven't been able to participate in any way in any kind of political organizing. I found small things I've been able to do here and there, but the Crown, in defining the term demonstration as including any public meeting in which any political or moral views are expressed. For example, just last night was the book launch for the book G20, Whose Streets Are Streets, or whatever it was called. My lawyer advised me not to even go to that, even though it was mostly just a party.
So even a book launch?
Yeah, so a year and a half later, I still am not able to attend things like a book launch.
How much of that time did you spend in detention?
I've spent 5 months in detention so far and will have been given another 13 and a half that I'll have to start serving in the spring.
And then were you also under some kind of house arrest?
Yeah, 5 months under relatively strict house arrest.
So,
Now I'm still, like, I'm mandated to live at my father's house, still have a curfew and some other conditions. But, I mean, we've got a very strange... It's a strange part of the justice system in Canada, the way pre-trial custody and bail works, in that much more than in any other Western country, we have this presumption of guilt, so that if you don't have an acceptable family or job or living situation acceptable to the courts, you don't even get out of jail while you're waiting for your trial to come up. So we were able to get out, most of us, because we come from families where someone owns property. And that's what got most of us out of jail. Our friend Ryan Rainville, who was charged separately, he spent his entire bail period before his charges. He recently just got sentenced, actually, to a conditional sentence. He's going to have to spend another 4 months on house arrest at a men's shelter, because he doesn't have family here. It's important for people to remember that, as ridiculous as what we went through felt like, it is the way the system deals with most people. So while Peter Hopperton has been transferred, Eric Lankin and Adam Lewis, who have already gone into custody, who pled guilty to counsel to mischief, they're sitting at the Toronto West Detention Center, where most people haven't had their trials or sentencing yet. And most people are sitting there trying to decide, do I want to sit in jail and wait for my trial when I will probably beat my charges, or just plead guilty now and get it over with?
Let's turn to the plea deal now. Why did you and the other co-defendants choose this approach as opposed to challenging your charges in court?
We had the opportunity to get 11 of 17 people off of their charges. A couple of whom had various reasons in their lives why they really needed to get this dealt with sooner rather than later and didn't want to take the risks associated with going to trial. And in order to get those 11 people off of these charges and back on the street organizing, those of us who were not very likely to beat all of the charges anyways decided it was acceptable to take the deal now. I mean, I am a person who very much believes that once you get caught up in the legal process, that it is important to engage with it and to have those fights at trial. I think we don't get a lot of opportunities better than a big public trial to actually interact with the dominant public narrative. But in order to get some of our friends and allies off so they could get back to what they do, to avoid the deportation in one case, to let people get on with their lives who were very seriously impacted by all this, it was an acceptable solution.
What was the process of decision-making like to come to that understanding as a group?
A series of consensus meetings. So we met as often as we could. It was very difficult because we had to have lawyers present for us to meet because we had non-association conditions. But it was just a series of meetings where we weighed our goals and our values against, you know, the circumstances that we found ourselves in under which we had very little control.
Now, the evidence in the case against you and in your co-defendants, it has been revealed through that evidence that the police forces across the country conducted one of the largest spy operations in Canadian history, as I said in my introduction. Who was targeted within that spy operation?
Well, so the primary targets of the broader operation tended to be radical activist groups involved in either indigenous solidarity, explicitly anarchist, or migrant justice organizing. The primary targets tended to be groups that use and employ analyses that are a little more radical, and that tend to advocate slightly more confrontational analyses and tactics. But it was by no means limited to groups like that. So there were also a host of environmental organizations infiltrated in various ways, legal collectives, media collectives, feminist collectives, all sorts of groups. I mean, we know of at least a dozen groups across the country that were infiltrated in the lead up to the Olympics and the G8, G20. Some of them as mainstream as the Law Unions Movement Defense Committee and Greenpeace. But I think the primary targets were this kind of like triangular network of indigenous solidarity and sovereignty-based groups, migrant justice and anti-racist-based groups, and then anarchist and anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist groups.
And what kind of methods were used?
I haven't had the opportunity to talk in depth with some of the other groups that were infiltrated about this, because it was only through our disclosure evidence that I was able to, for myself, verify where some of these infiltrations had been, and before that it had been a lot of rumor. But I think in general what they did was they exploited weaknesses in our own activist culture. So in some of the anarchist groups that were infiltrated, one of the things they exploited was our values around inclusivity and anti-racism, and also some of the cultural aspects of anarchist communities were really exploited and used against us. So, for example, in the case of Brenda Doherty, the infiltrator the undercover who infiltrated in Guelph. Her story was that she was a survivor of an abusive relationship. And because she had done her research and used the right language around survivor and abuse and anti-patriarchal language, she was able to use that to cover up the fact that we couldn't trace her past and who she was or what she was doing in the community. And she used that to ingratiate herself and to make people want to help her and trust her. Bindo Shoen, the guy who we came to know as Khalid Muhammad, had actually tried to infiltrate Guelph before he came to Kitchener and had done a bunch of really, really sketchy things there. And they actually kind of kicked him out of town. But lines of communication really fell apart between Guelph and Kitchener. And when he came to Kitchener, he wasn't doing those really sketchy things anymore. But the communication was shut down because he also fed rumors that some of that conflict was based on racism. And so I think people who had actually kicked him out were very scared to tell people they had kicked him out for fear of being accused of racism. People in Kitchener were scared to interrogate the reasons he was there for fear of kind of inadequate anti-racist culture amongst ourselves. And I think that a big part of what happened there, that breakdown, was that while, you know, both in Guelph and in Kitchener and in most places where there are young anarchist communities, people take anti-racism very, very, very seriously and care a lot about it. But because the young anarchist communities tend to be mostly dominated by young white people, there are still, you know, subtle and unintentional failures of that anti-racist culture within those communities. And we don't do a good enough job at being open about and talking about it and working on the ways we still need to get much, much better at our own anti-racist or, you know, anti-patriarchal or anti-heteronormative cultures. And that we have a lot of work to do with it, being more open about it. And it is my suspicion that things like that, that are actually the most positive parts of our cultures that were exploited to get in. It's my guess that the same types of methods and strategies were used by the infiltrators across the country.
Alex, when are you getting sentenced?
I will be doing my sentencing sometime in the spring.
And do you know how long you're going to get?
Yeah, I'll be getting 13 and a half months. I mean, 20 months minus credit for time served. So the number we've landed at is 13 and a half.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking our call today. It's been great to talk to you.
Oh, no problem. Thank you very much for having me.
I've been speaking with Alex Hundert. He's one of the G20 defendants in the so-called G20 main conspiracy group. Alex blogs regularly at alexhundert.wordpress.com. If you would like to read a statement from the 17 G20 defendants, you can go to another WordPress site, and this one is conspiretoresist.wordpress.com. And this site also features information about how you can provide prison support to the people who have already been sentenced.